This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
What is Dax, are you?
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all, so we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
So now Valpo's going to have to go the length of the court. 2.5. The inbounds pass to be thrown by Jamie Sykes. Carter pressuring. It's to Jenkins. The Drew for the win.
Gone.
Oh! He did it.
Bryce Drew did it. Valpo has won the game. A miracle.
That's one of the all-time buzzer-beating March Madness moments. Just over 27 years ago now, Bryce Drew, deep from the right wing at the buzzer on a beautiful play. Length of the court pass touched to Bryce Drew in one motion. 13th-seeded Valpo, shocking upset over the 4-seed that day. Ole Miss, a shot that we see every March. Bryce Drew is the head coach of Grand Canyon University. He joins me right now. Grand Canyon and Maryland Friday in the first round, 4:35 Eastern in Seattle. You can hear the game right here on your home for Terps basketball, the Team 980. Coach, thanks for making time for us. Really appreciate it. We'll get to your team and the matchup on Friday against Maryland in a minute or two. Over the years, as you've told the story of that shot, that game, I would imagine that at this point it's either gotten old or creatively you've just run out of ways to tell the tale of the Bryce Drew shot in 1998.
I think I've used them all. and I try to keep it factual. I try not to change the story as I get older. It definitely warms my heart, because I have so many great, friends on that journey and memories. And, it was such a special time, you know, in my life. College athletics, you know, stick with you for a lifetime. And so, definitely thankful for that opportunity.
You know, legendary moments like the one you produced and were involved in, sometimes with the passage of time, they get distorted in the retelling of that moment. You know, hyperbole becomes a big part of the tale, you know, many years later. Do you ever have people come up to you and tell you about that moment and they're just off with respect to the details? Like somehow it's even, you know, it's grown even bigger than it was. And that's pretty hard for that moment to have a bigger retelling than what actually did happen. But I'm just curious if anybody ever comes up and you're just like, no, that's not exactly what happened.
Yeah, no, most people have pretty accurate. You know, again, it was so long ago. So, you know, it used to be like, you know, the longer clip. Now it's a very short clip if they do show it.
Right.
And the sound bite's not as long. Growing up, you know, like you talked earlier, my family's in coaching, so we always watch the NCAA tournament. So to have, you know, that game and that moment, it's just, you know, it's always been special to me. So I'm very thankful.
That play that was drawn up for that game winner, you know, your father was the head coach. That was such a well-designed play. Length of the court pass, you know, it's caught, and in one motion, it's touch pass to you on the wing where you caught it in your shooting, you know, setup and motion. And it was just so beautiful to watch. And I may be wrong about this, but I think that was the first time we had ever seen that play. We've seen it a lot since. Do you have any recollection or knowledge as to whether or not, you know, that last second, you know, that under 5 seconds, it was 2.5 seconds left, you know, length of the court needing, you know, a shot to tie or win the game, if that was the first time something like that was run?
It's the first one I know of. I know my dad got the play from the Indiana Pacers. I think Bob Hill was the coach. So I don't know if maybe they won a game on it. But for us, we ran it once that year earlier, and we actually lost. We didn't even get a shot up. And so we moved some pieces around. And then that was the second time that we ran it, you know, in the NCAA tournament. So, but since then, it's been really cool. You know, I'll get an email or I'll get a text message or a video, you know, of a high school team or a junior high team that runs it and they win the game.
Well, I mean, I think we've seen that play so many times drawn up, and it's, you know, it's called essentially or referred to as the Bryce Drew or the Valpo play.
Yeah, I know, pretty special. But just like anything, you know, that was taken from someone else. So we took it from the Pacers. So we actually called it Pacers.
Yeah, but you guys made it work. Well, you are, you know, clearly one of the legends of this time of year, and now you've got a team in the tournament for the third straight year. You guys pulled off the upset last year in the first round over St. Mary's. Terp fans are listening to this. Tell us what we're going to see in Grand Canyon on Friday.
Well, you know, we've had some adversity this year, so you know, we do have some experience. We have some older players that have been around. So, you know, we definitely like that. You know, we played a pretty tough non-conference schedule, I think, which has helped us. But, you know, obviously, you know, Maryland's one of the best teams in the country. They're battle-tested, you know, through and through throughout the year. And they obviously will present some concerns and issues that we haven't faced, you know, in quite a while. So, you know, we're excited, but we obviously know what a tall task it is to play them.
Was there a team on your schedule this year that resembled Maryland?
You know, I don't think completely, but, you know, Georgia, yep. We play Georgia, and they have, you know, two bigs that are really good, and they had three perimeter guys, you know, that could shoot the ball. But again, you know, Maryland's a top 11 team in the country, so you can't really completely compare it because the level of play you know, that Maryland's been playing at to finish second in the Big Ten is you know, extremely high level.
It would seem, just based on some of the numbers out there, that stylistically you guys like to get up and down the floor. You like a lot of pace. You like a lot of possessions in the game. Is that an accurate description of the way that you guys like to play?
Yes, you know, we're top. I think we're top 20 in tempo, and so you know, we definitely like to get up and down, and so but I do like our team has the ability to play slower too, and I do like that, you know, that we're able to play, you know, two different styles. You know, I think that's important throughout the year in college basketball.
You've talked a little bit about Maryland, but give me some more detail. What's the scouting report? You guys had to put something together once you saw it was Maryland on Sunday night on the pairing show. What do you think of the Terps?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to find, you know, holes. You know, sixth in the country defensively, I think top 30 offensively. And so you look at just those numbers alone, and that kind of speaks for itself, you know, what they've accomplished this year. And you know, some of their numbers are just, you know, tremendous, from their three-point percentage to free throw percentage to rebounding, and just the efficiency that you know, these guys play with. And so, you know, they're a fun team to watch. You know, when you're watching film, you know, they can press you and beat you. You know, they can beat you, you know, in their zone. They can beat you with their man. They can beat you outside. They can beat you inside. And so, you know, Kevin's done a really good job assembling a really good team and putting the pieces all where they need to be.
This is the first matchup, you know, obviously between Maryland and Grand Canyon, but I'm curious, have you ever coached against Kevin? Did you match up with him at any point when you were the head coach at Vanderbilt and he was at Seton Hall?
You know, we played him when he was at Iona years ago.
Okay.
And we're, you know, obviously he does a tremendous job. One of the best coaches in the country.
So without disclosing the game plan, which you're not going to do, just give me a few of the keys from your perspective on Friday's game. What do you guys need to do to have a chance to move on?
I mean, there's a lot of things that obviously, you know, go into it. You know, with the NCAA tournament, you know, it's a one-game season, you know, for everybody. And, you know, at the end of the day, like my dad always says, usually boils down to who makes more shots. And so, you know, sometimes in the day, it's, you know, who gets to the free throw line more, who shoots a better percent from there, who takes care of the ball, doesn't turn it over, who rebounds better. You know, those are kind of the similarities, I think, you know, at any game, at any level.
Do you feel like the experience that you have, and you'd have to tell me how many of your players were on the team last year that won a game and got to the second round, but that it's not just about happy to be there, that there's a confidence and there's a feeling that, you know, you've been there, done that?
I mean, they know the routine. We have guys that have been there, you know, this will be their second, some their third. Another guy will be his fourth NCAA tournament. And so, you know, they know the routine. They know the steps to get there, which does allow you to focus on the game more since guys have gone through this process before.
How much does your personal experience with the shot that we talked about, how does that allow you to frame when you're coaching Grand Canyon? It was different, you know, at Vanderbilt when you're in the SEC. That this time of year, you know, has produced these moments in that, you know, anything's possible. It doesn't matter about seeding. It doesn't matter about point spreads. How much do you use your personal experience to let your team know that it's more than possible?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the advantages of having an experienced team is, you know, they kind of form their own opinions.
Yeah.
Sometimes good, sometimes bad. you know, they have a pretty good understanding of the landscape and, you know, what goes into these games. And, you know, many of them have been in many, you know, high-level, big-time games. You know, in AAU, a lot of our players have played against, you know, most players around the country. And so, you know, it's definitely a different time and era. Then when I played, I think everyone's more familiar with each other. And, you know, they've kind of, you know, been through some of these experiences before. So, you know, hopefully, you know, all those things, you know, help our guys feel comfortable and settle in sooner than later in the game.
Tell me just about Grand Canyon and the university, because you took over there, you know, I think it was the year after COVID. This is your, I think, fourth trip in 5 years with this school to the NCAA tournament. When did Grand Canyon become Division I, and when did it become, you know, the power of the WAC?
Yeah, you know, only been Division I for, you know, a handful of years before I got here. And, you know, it's almost a biblical story. It had 1,500 students in 2006, and now we have 25,000.
Wow.
And we have 90,000 online. And so, it's amazing, you know, how fast this school has grown. And, you know, we have great fan engagement. You know, our fan base is tremendous. And it's just been really fun to kind of be part of this growth process, you know, through my 5 years here, you know, at Grand Canyon.
So what does the family do with both your brother and you coaching in the tournament? How do they divvy that up?
Yeah, that's a tough one. Yeah, you know, for 2 days, my dad was back and forth, you know, should I go see Scott or you? And so at the end of the day, I think we're going to get him with us. He's in Phoenix now, and so I think the travel will be a little bit easier for him to just come with us. So we're happy to get him, but I know he'll be tuned in to my brother's game in Raleigh.
Yeah, because they play the same day, just earlier in the day. I would wish you the best of luck if you were playing anybody but Maryland. So I will leave it at that. But, you know, they have, I don't know if you know this, but their last four losses have essentially come at the buzzer. You know, they lost on Saturday to Michigan with 0.4 seconds left. They lost on a 60-footer by Trey Holloman from Michigan State in College Park at the buzzer. They lost on a banked-in three to Ohio State with about 5 seconds to go, and they lost at the buzzer against Northwestern. That's their last four losses.
That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, unheard of. We hope it's not a fifth that way, but... You've always been somebody that I think college basketball fans have really enjoyed your story and watched the family story over the years. Wish you the best as far as everything, but on Friday afternoon in Seattle.
I get it. Don't worry. It's great talking to you, and thanks for having me on.
Bryce Drew, everybody, the head coach at Grand Canyon, Terps and Antelopes on Friday at 4:35. This is his fifth season there. 120-39 overall record. 63-21 in the WAC. That's the conference Grand Canyon is in. And this is his fourth NCAA tournament trip in his five seasons. In the season that he didn't make it, they were still 23-8. So the guy's doing a phenomenal job there. He coached at Valpo, remember, in the 2010s, in the early 2010s, took them to the tournament two or three times, and then just didn't get it done at Vanderbilt. Tough place to win. Although Vandy, it's easier to win in basketball than football. But went from there to Grand Canyon the year after COVID. All right, up next, we'll do some Denton news. Then we will head out to Vegas, talk to Patrick Everson, and talk some tournament and gambling with him at 11:35. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, theteam980.com. We're also free and live on the Odyssey app.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hey, it's Jim Costa with Cash the Ticket. It's March, so Mike Valeni and I are all over the tournament again this year. There's just nothing like betting in March. Breakdowns of every region and every game. From conference tournaments to the Final Horn, we'll have the picks and the plays on every single game. Cinderella spotlights, upset alerts, and some of that value for the last team standing. It's tourney time, so hunker down and bet the board with us. Subscribe and listen to Cash the Ticket in the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, Denton, what do you have?
All right, let's start with the Capitals. They were in action last night against the Red Wings. They picked up a big-time win, 4-1. Unfortunately, no goals for Alex Ovechkin. So 8 remains the number. The team is in action at home on Thursday to take on the Flyers. Hopefully, Alex Ovechkin cuts into it then.
Remember, we talked yesterday, and I mentioned to you that it wouldn't shock me if, you know, the people that are selling the Caps product both in arena and through Monumental, if they wouldn't mind if he held off until next year to break the record, that they'd have a whole, you know, several months to build up next season and sell the hell out of it. Yeah, somebody told me that I was definitely onto something with that thinking, that would definitely be the preference of certainly salespeople. That would be a big deal to be able to sell the 2025-2026 Caps on Monumental with Ovechkin, you know, due at some point early in the season to break Gretzky's record.
He become a money-making machine. We'll keep an eye on that. I still hope he breaks the record this year. I hope he breaks the record this year. They win a Stanley Cup this year, and then he can decide whether or not he wants to keep it going after that. That'd be like the perfect way, perfect send-off.
Yeah, it would be one of those things if he didn't break the record. By the way, for those of you that don't know, and I bet you that there are some that don't know, I didn't know this until a few months back. The goals in the playoffs don't count. All right, so no matter what he scores in the playoffs, that does not count in terms of overall goals. It's a regular season Gretzky mark that he holds. But, you know, imagine the Caps win the cup. He wins his second cup. And in a lot of cases, at what, 40 years old, near 40 years old, he might, you know, ride into the sunset, but not if he doesn't break the record. He's coming back.
Yeah, for the record, he has 72 goals in the postseason right now, so he's like way over 950 in terms of total goals scored.
Well, what are Gretzky's goals in the postseason?
I would assume that he's very high as well.
Yeah.
Wayne Gretzky's playoff goals are 122.
Ovechkin's 75, you said?
72. So there's a 50 goal difference when it comes to postseason.
Well, Edmonton, under when Gretzky was there, consistently went further in the playoffs than the Caps have under Ovechkin. I would imagine that Gretzky's number of playoff games played, number of playoff wins is much higher than Alex Ovechkin's.
I mean, he's played 200 playoff games.
Yeah, what's Ovechkin played?
Alex Ovechkin has not played 200, I can tell you that. We'd have a lot more Stanley Cup trophies, hopefully.
I mean, probably should have with some of the teams they had, you know, based on their finishing record.
So he's actually played more than I thought, 151.
But I think the playoffs are expanded versus what they were back then. I could be wrong about that. I don't know. They, you know, back then they did divisional, you know, like the Patrick division, you had the top four finishers in the Patrick division play best of fives against each other in the first round. And then out of that, you know, you'd play, one would play four, two would play three. The winners would play in the second round. And then the third round was the Eastern Conference Finals against the other Eastern Conference. I think it was the Adams division. I think I'm right about that. The one that Boston was in and Buffalo was in, et cetera. I'm going to go back and look at NHL standings from like 1987. That was the year that the Caps lost that marathon game seven in the first round to the Islanders. See how the playoffs with the divisions. Adams division was Montreal, Boston, Buffalo, Hartford, and Quebec. The Patrick division, Islanders, Flyers, Caps, Devils, Rangers, Penguins. The Norris was Detroit, St. Louis, Chicago, Toronto, Minnesota. And the Smythe was Calgary, Edmonton, Winnipeg, LA, and Vancouver. And the playoffs would be, as I described, you know, a best of five. And then the second round would go best of seven, conference finals, best of seven, Stanley Cup finals. So Gretzky also had the opportunity to play, had the opportunity initially to play fewer games because the series were shorter. You still win three series to get to the Stanley Cup,
right? Stanley Cup, right.
Yeah. It's just the way it's formatted. But Edmonton was consistently deep into the postseason and in the Stanley Cup Finals. All right, what else?
Two new NFL rule proposals. These come both from the Detroit Lions. The first one is that they have proposed a new postseason format that would allow wild card teams to be seeded higher than division champions if their record is greater. So, for instance, when the NFC South is a bad team winning, you might get the Commanders having a home game versus the Buccaneers rather than going to Tampa. The second one, which I think is actually a little bit more impactful, the Lions have proposed a rule that would remove the automatic first down for defensive holding and illegal contact penalties if you are, for an example, legal contact's 5 yards. If it's a third and seven, you just get the 5 yards and it's third and two again rather than the automatic first down.
Yeah, I love both of those. I've been screaming about both of those things for years. I do not think that qualifying for the playoffs, the structure for qualifying for the playoffs should change. Four division winners, you win your division, even if you're 7-10 or 8-9, you are in. And then the next three best records would be wild cards. But once you've determined the seven teams, based on that, four division winners and three wild cards. You then seed based on record, 1-7. In that case, last year, as an example, Detroit would have been the one. Philadelphia still would have been the two. Minnesota would have been the three, and Washington would have been the four seed. All right, so they would have hosted a first-round wild card weekend matchup 4-5. And they would have played Green Bay. Green Bay would have been the five. And then you would have had, who had the better conference? You would have Tampa Bay would have been the six, and the Rams would have been the seven seed. They would have been the last seed in the NFC. So Washington would have hosted Green Bay in a first-round game, in a 4-5 game, and then, you know, the NFL playoffs are not, you know, they are seed contingent. So highest seed, remaining seed plays lowest remaining seed, etc. Yeah, I like that. And I, as far as defensive holding and illegal contact, it's been way too punitive over the years. Third and there's nothing worse than a 3rd-and-15, and you get an illegal contact on, by the way, a play that gets blown up, the quarterback gets sacked, or he throws a quick bubble screen to one side of the field, and they call illegal contact that had nothing to do with the play on the other side of the field. You know, you're going to throw that flag 5 yards, replay the down. I'm all for that. I like both of those proposals. What about the fourth down proposal, the overtime proposal? Any of that stuff out there?
I have not seen
anything.
Not
the fourth down, excuse me, the onside kick proposal, you know, moving to a 4th-and-15 or a 4th-and-17.
I have not seen anything about that, but I will keep an eye out on that as we
I think
progress.
We're going to get overtime next year, 15 minutes. I think we're going to get the playoff rule, other than it can end in a tie in the regular season. You know, you're not going to go on and play a second overtime. I think we're going to get 15 minutes, and I think a touchdown does not end it on the opening drive. The other team will get a shot. And that'll change the strategy, you know, just like it should have for Kyle Shanahan in the Super Bowl, you know, last year. You know, if you win the toss, you don't take the football now. You defer. So you know what you need when you get the ball because you're guaranteed to get the ball. He made that mistake against the Chiefs in the postseason, in the Super Bowl. All right, what else?
All right, final thing here before we get to Patrick Everson. Quarterback is returning for season two. They announced it via a trailer that was kind of a spoof trailer. They said they made it look like they were doing a quarterback, but for mascots, and then they pulled the rug out at the end. It's going to be Kirk Cousins again, Joe Burrow, and Jared Goff as the three
quarterbacks. No, it's not.
It is.
What?
Yeah. You're pumped up. I didn't watch receiver that much because I wasn't all that interested, but I'm interested with the quarterbacks.
Why would they pick Kirk Cousins? He may not even play next year.
Well, remember, this is last year. So it's documenting. He's perfect because it's documenting everything that took place last year.
You're saying the quarterback that's coming out on Netflix this summer is Cousins, Goff, and who else?
And Joe Burrow.
Wow. Did we know that?
We do now. We'd heard rumors.
We do now, but we didn't know that during the season, right?
No, we did not. We'd heard rumors that last year, before they decided to go with receiver, Burrow was one of the only quarterbacks that was open to doing it, which is why they went with receiver. They had six. I felt like it was a little too jumbled. That's just too many guys to keep up with. But with only three quarterbacks, and like we know how those seasons went. You know, Jared Goff went really well, and then his season ended, I think, perfectly. He would obviously disagree with that. Burrow was an MVP candidate with a bad defense, and then Kirk was, I am going to be the guy in Atlanta, now I'm not.
Look, if I were Cousins, I wouldn't have done it. He was the star of the first one. He came off really well. I wouldn't have done it again. I also think it's, you know, to have your team, no one ever said about Mahomes or Mariota or Cousins or even the receiver show that it was distracting for the rest of the team, but I would imagine that there's some distraction to it.
Maybe, but I feel like with the birth and like a bigger range of social media teams nowadays, I feel like players are just used to having cameras all over the place because everyone does like their own version of this to an extent.
Right. All right. If you've got anything else, we'll get to it later. We got a guest coming up. Patrick Everson will be our guest from Vegas. We'll talk tournament and gambling next. Two first four games last night, two more tonight, and then we get the show, which starts tomorrow at noon or shortly thereafter. Maryland here, 4:35 on Friday against Grand Canyon. We just had Bryce Drew on the show. If you missed it, you can catch it on the Odyssey app or at the team980.com. Joining us now is Patrick Everson. Love having Patrick on the show. Senior reporter at Vegas Insider. He's out in the desert, and this is a great time of the year. And I was scrolling through your most recent tweets on X, and you can follow Patrick, by the way, at @PatrickE_Vegas on X. And you tweeted out, back in the 80s and 90s, we couldn't wait for Sports Illustrated to hit our mailboxes the week March Madness began. Tearing out that bracket, filling it out, and taping it on the wall by the TV. It was a simpler time, and it was awesome. I don't remember... I do remember the Sports Illustrated bracket, you know, and the fold-out. But I always remember having to wait until the next day to get the bracket in the paper, you know, in the Washington Post for me, and fill it out that way. There was no filling it out online, but the bracket that you put out was the 1990 tournament. That was a great tournament. You know, you put up the whole bracket and all the scores. There were some memorable games that year. I don't know if you remember some of them.
Oh, absolutely. I remember them. If I'm not mistaken, I think the Final Four was in Denver that year.
It was.
I'm a Colorado kid. I grew up in Colorado. And UNLV was just a fascinating watch at that stage. They were just amazing every year. And then to your point on some of these other teams, Loyola, that was Loyola Marymount's big year, and the whole Hank Gathers thing and so forth. The you know, tragedy there, obviously, but the team really picked it up and made a nice run, and they were incredible. They were like UNLV in a sense. Those two teams actually played each other, and it was, I think it was UNLV 131, Loyola Marymount 101 in the Elite Eight or something. Just and as you noted, as you look at that bracket on there on the post that I have on X, it brings it all back. You're like, oh my gosh, Duke UNLV in the final, UNLV running away with it. Lots of great games on that bracket. It was just amazing. And I did want to say, as you segued back onto the air here from commercial break, perfect choice of song with that great tune from the Smashing Pumpkins. Well, today is the greatest day and so forth. That's that'll be tomorrow, but you're previewing what's to come, and I like it.
I actually just saw them a couple of months ago. Billy Corgan's a little bit insufferable, but one of the great bands of all time. But back to the 90 NCAA basketball tournament and your thing. So the Sweet 16 games, I'll never forget Tate George hitting a shot to beat Clemson at the buzzer. Kenny Anderson beat Michigan State at the buzzer on a shot that clearly came after the clock hit zeros and the light went on, but they didn't have a replay. They knocked out, it was Judd Heathcote's Michigan State team at the time. You mentioned UNLV. They barely beat Ball State. Loyola beat Alabama by two. And then you got the first of the Leitner game winners in the Elite Eight when they beat UConn. How about the fact that Loyola Marymount, everybody, I mean, I'm sure some of you, most of you are old enough to remember Hank Gathers and the tragic passing, and then Bo Kimble shooting the free throw left-handed. But they won a game early in that tournament against Michigan, Denton, 149-115. Wasn't it, Patrick, that Paul Westhead essentially tried to take a shot within 10 seconds of taking possession of the ball? That was kind of the goal.
I think I remember that. They want to get the ball, inbound it, get up the court, and shoot within 10 seconds. They were firing fast all the time, whether it was an inbound or off a rebound or whatever. The outlet was there. They were running. They were shooting. They were not prone to wasting any time at all. So super entertaining watch. Not necessarily going to see a lot of defense. I mean, you can look at some of the. They did get they barely got past Alabama in even a low-scoring game by today's standards, after that Michigan win.
Right.
But goodness, 149-115 over Michigan. UNLV beats Loyola Marymount 131-101. I mean, a college 40-minute college basketball game where you had 232 points scored. I wonder what that one went over.
I wonder what the total was. I bet it was probably like 180-something. That would be my guess.
Yeah, I would bet you're right. I'll bet it's something like 180, somewhere in the 180s. And there was a couple. There's been a couple of games in the conference tournaments last week that had some pretty high numbers because of the way, you know, Alabama and Florida racked up points. They probably couldn't make it high enough. I'm sure people kept betting it, but I don't think anybody expected 232 points. That's just an insane amount of points. Especially back in that day.
Yeah. Well, 149-115, when you're talking about 264 points in a game, that's insane. That was a second-round game. You know, I still think in my lifetime of being a massive college basketball fan, I think that UNLV team, and even the UNLV team the year later that lost to Duke in the Final Four, mm-hmm. I think though that UNLV squad with Larry Johnson and Stacey Augmon and Greg Anthony and Anderson Hunt and I'm forgetting a couple of the other players. I think that's the greatest college basketball team of my lifetime.
I would be hard pressed to argue against it. Look, I'm here in Vegas. I'm not necessarily a UNLV guy, but obviously I've been in Vegas since '94. Just as the UNLV kind of, I don't know if I'd call it a dynasty, but certainly really long stretch of excellence. That team was something else. It was hard to match that starting five for sure. And even they had a couple guys coming off the bench that were great as well. Definitely one of the all-timers in NCAA men's NCAA basketball history.
Yep. All right. By the way, in mentioning all the points that were scored during that, you know, back in the day, the college basketball has seen, and I don't know, and I was talking to Denton about this, I think, last week or maybe early this week. It struck me that this year was a very high-scoring year. It clearly was in the SEC, but that it was in a lot of places. And I looked it up. The last 2 years, actually, we've seen a massive increase in the number of teams that average at least 80 points per game. Has that been a trend? Of course, Vegas picks up on every trend. But have you seen higher totals this year than maybe 2, 3, 4 years ago?
So I would, you know, look, going through the Super Bowl, I was over my skis in between college football and NFL and took a little time off and then finally was able to kind of start diving into some of this college basketball with the conference tournament. And what I agree. I mean, what I was noticing as I was writing over the last 2 weeks on conference tournaments pretty regularly was these totals on these games that I was previewing were, you know, significantly higher. They just seemed significantly higher. And again, not just in the SEC. I mean, this is across the board. You were seeing, maybe not quite across the board, but in a lot more conferences than you'd expect, you were seeing a lot higher numbers. I'm taking a look at some stats just to see, you know, what the percentage was on over and unders for the whole season for all games. And it's pretty close. So the bookmakers did a pretty good job here. I'm looking at if you're looking at overs and unders on you have a slight edge to a non-overtime games, Kevin. You got about about 48.5% of games went over, and 51.6% of games went under. And this is literally hundreds and hundreds of games. This has like 2,500. 5,200 some odd games or something like that. So it didn't change the percentage as much. And in fact, there were a few more unders than overs. But I assume if you were an over bettor in the SEC or on some of these teams that really like to run, you probably did yourself pretty well this season.
Yeah, and I was actually just more curious about the average number. If the average total has gone up, I would imagine that it has.
I would say so. It was something I only kind of noticed during the conference tournaments, but there were some sizable numbers out there.
Well, trust me. I mean, here in Washington, we've never gone this long talking about football games like we did this year with Washington making it to the NFC title game. So we got to college basketball late as well. You know, it's interesting, though, Patrick, and I've said this a lot about the sport, and I love the sport, but it really, over the last 10 to 15 years maybe, has become for most sports fans a one-month you know, on the calendar sport, and it's this tournament. It's March. You know, most casual sports fans do not pay attention to college basketball anymore during football season. They just don't.
No, I agree. It's and especially the NFL. The NFL is what drives the American sports betting fan and or sports fan, and also the American sports betting. You know, collectively, that's the butter on the bread and so forth. There's nothing that can really overtake the NFL, and it just gets everybody's attention. And college football, having added the playoff, and then this year with the playoff being expanded, it just dominates for months on end. And you've got, you know, college basketball starting back in like late October, early November, whenever it is. And, you know, by the time you get to the Super Bowl being done in almost mid-February in some cases now, depending on how the dates fall, it just doesn't really get on people's radars. And then everybody kind of, there's kind of that post-mortem when the Super Bowl is over and everybody's like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do till August? And then, you know, you get to the beginning of March and you're like, oh, well, here's something really fun to do. Remember this? But yeah, I'm glad it's a little unfortunate. It'd be nice if it, because it is fun all season long. It can't, you know, college basketball is just fantastic. And there's just so many great games and great conferences and great teams to watch. But at least it dominates this month like nothing else. And honestly, this is a, you know, the Super Bowl as a single day event, that's the largest single day sports betting event in the nation. But March Madness, it's 2.5 weeks, basically. It's 3 full weekends. It is the biggest sports betting event in America in totality. It outstrips the Super Bowl because you've got all these games over all these days going for, you know, 3 weekends straight. So it's a massive, massive event for sure.
Yeah. There are a lot of us that love, you know, Thursday and Friday and having a lot of action from 12 noon until, you know, usually about 1 a.m. Eastern when the last game finally ends. All right, let's talk big picture. You know, it seems to me, and you can share with us, you know, what the odds are. It seems to me that there is some separation in terms of favorites in this tournament between the 4-1s and then maybe a big drop off after that, or maybe even the top three, you know, Duke, Florida, and Houston, and everybody else. Duke's the favorite, I'm assuming. How big of a favorite, and how much are these, you know, one seeds, you know, sort of respected odds wise heading into it?
Right. What you're seeing is exactly what's going on. The one seeds are absolutely seen as head and shoulders above everybody else in this tournament. There's a significant drop off. I'm looking at BetMGM's odds right now, but this is the case everywhere where it's BetMGM, DraftKings, Caesars, etc. A little bit of a difference between books on where they have Duke, Florida, Auburn. Some books have Duke and Auburn close together. Some books have Duke and Auburn or Duke and Florida close together. But those top four teams, BetMGM, for example, right now, Duke plus 325 to win the championship. Still the favorite, so I think they're expecting, you know, Cooper Flagg to be healthy at some point. Cooper Flagg doesn't have to play in this first game. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't, but maybe he will. But Duke and Florida plus 325 co-favorites to win it all. Then you go plus 400, 4-1 on Auburn, so that's pretty close. And then Houston at 6-1. And then you go all the way down to 16-1 for Alabama, 18-1 for Tennessee, and then another little gap, and then you've got 25-1 for Michigan State, St. John's, and so on. So that's a pretty decent drop off after those first four teams. They definitely feel like those first, the winner is going to be one of those first four teams.
Where's Maryland right now to win the whole thing?
So Maryland to win the whole thing, and this again, this is BetMGM, but so your mileage may vary. Always shop around, as I'm sure you tell your listeners. They are 50-1, but that puts them in like the top 15 or so, top 12 to 15 or so. They're 50-1 along with Arizona, Gonzaga, and Wisconsin. So they're in some pretty good company. Some teams that have looked good of late, and you know, they may be worth, you know, maybe it's worth a shot. Maybe you don't think they win the championship. Maybe take the Maryland to make the Final Four or something like that.
What is that number right now? Like 15-1?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure if they have that on there, but I'm going to take a look and see if they do. It's probably, tournament progression. Yes, here we go. So Maryland to make the Final Four, and again, this is from BetMGM.
Maybe less than 15-1,
actually. 9-1 to make the Final Four.
Yeah.
So pretty decent payout there, plus 4.25 to make the eight. So that's maybe something to think about. Plus 400 to make the eights, you know, $100 to make $400 or so. That's, you know, that's a possibility. That's a decent team.
Where do you think most of the liability is for most of the shops? Is it Duke winning the whole thing?
I think it is. And the thing is, oftentimes it doesn't work out that way with the favorite being the biggest liability, because generally that team has been fairly short all season long.
Right.
But there, I've seen some Duke tickets out there at, like, you know, 12-1 in that range, 10-1, 12-1, 14-1, that sort of thing. And it can add up kind of quick, even at those numbers. They're not huge. It's not like a 30 or a 40 or a 100-1. But it adds up because so many people just got on the Duke bandwagon. But Florida is a real problem for quite a few books.
Really?
Because you could have gotten Florida early in the season at early season at 50-1, 60-1. There's a lot of tickets like that out there. And then specifically at BetMGM, this person got in way late. They wish they would have put this money down on Florida a lot earlier in the season. This had to come in like the last week or two, Kevin. $100,000 at 9-1 on Florida. So
wow,
that will make your liability stand out quite a bit there. That's a $900,000 ticket if Florida goes all the way. So Florida is definitely a problem. Duke's a problem. Auburn is an issue. You could have gotten a little bit better numbers on Auburn a little bit earlier in the season. Those are probably three key liabilities among teams that are seen as ones that could legitimately win.
Patrick Everson from Vegas Insider joining us. Just real quickly, because I want to ask you about some of the first-round games. But were there odds? I thought I read something the other day that West Virginia wasn't even listed as odds-wise to get into the field, and that I think it was Indiana was like minus 3,000 early Sunday morning to get in the field. Carolina was like plus 200 to get in the field. Do you know anything about, you know, where those last few spots were odds wise on Sunday?
Yeah, that was something I didn't even really have on my radar until Sunday. And I saw a little bit of what you're talking about, but those are, you know, I didn't get a good look at those, to be perfectly honest. And
no worries,
but I'm not surprised that North Carolina's number was as short as it was, because you just knew, you know, they're good. The committees, I'm not saying they did anything right or wrong, but they wanted to find a way to get them in.
All right, let's look at these first round games Thursday, Friday, real quickly. And some of the matchups obviously haven't been solved yet. They will figure that out tonight. Do you have a sense of, you know, a couple of the big public plays where a lot of shops will have some needs on individual games?
No question. They will. I can tell you, this is a tournament where the public loves to actually get on underdogs a lot more so than they
You're
do,
right.
say in the NFL and so forth.
Yeah.
So, you know, UCSD, definitely a very public team, getting a lot of tickets and money on the spread, but also more so, and this is where they're the big problem, this is UC San Diego against Michigan, a 12 versus a 5, Kevin. Everybody loves those. So they'll be on UCSD on the money line as well, no question about it. They're going to be looking for the upset. In fact, I'm looking at BetMGM's numbers right now. I literally just got these a little bit ago. 67% of bets on the money line in that game and 60% of tickets on UCSD. And they're probably going to take UCSD on the spread too, but they'll be more apt to play the money line. They're doing the same thing with Yale against Texas A&M. The betting public is loving Yale at this point. So there's always trendy underdogs in the NCAA tournament, often in the 12-5 games, sometimes in these 13-4 games and so forth. And then a couple of other games that are just kind of interesting. Drake is another one. It's definitely the public is all over Drake against Missouri. Literally at on the spread and the money line at BetMGM, 85% of all bets on the spread, 79% of all money is on Drake, 93% of tickets, 96% of money on the money line is on Drake. So they are pounding Drake at this point. But sharp money is what took that line up to 6.5 in favor of Missouri there. I believe that started in the 4-4.5 range at some books. So you've got pros versus Joes in Drake versus Missouri for sure.
What about, like, it seems to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, just the number would indicate to me that one of the favorites the public likes is BYU laying a super short number against VCU.
That's, well, it, in the that may be the case. This is always going to vary from from sportsbook to sportsbook. Sometimes there's some consistency there, Kevin. What they're seeing, the public is on the same teams. But in this case, I mean, I'm literally looking at numbers. And again, keep in mind, the bulk of the money is going to come in on these games, day of game, closer to tip-off.
Sure.
But that said, looking at BetMGM's numbers from just this morning, it's 2-1 tickets and money on the spread for Virginia Commonwealth as the short underdog. And they're all over VCU as on the money line, too. 84% of bets, 77% of money. So,
interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
Because that number looks short to me.
I think BYU's a decent team.
Yeah, they've been killing people this year. Patrick, thanks. Always enjoy the conversation. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. You and all your listeners have a great March Madness.
Yep. Patrick Everson from Vegas Insider does a great job. Follow him if you're into, you know, where the public is, where the money's going. Patrick does a good job of kind of talking about that on social media, at @PatrickE_Vegas. Up next, John Crispin will join us. We'll talk tournament with him.